Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Broadway Podcast Network presents Giants in the Sky, How Sondheim and Lapine Went into the Woods, with me, Ben Rimmelauer. Today's guest, Robert Sean Leonard, Jack in the Playwrights Horizons Workshop.
Once upon a time.
Robert Sean Leonard played Jack in the workshop of Into the Woods at Playwrights Horizons, and the dual role of Jules and Bob in the most recent Broadway revival of Sunday in the Park with George. He won the 2001 Tony Award for Best Featured Actor in a Play for his performance in Tom Stoppard's The Invention of Love, and was also nominated in the same category for Candida and Long Day's Journey into Night. His other Broadway credits include Born Yesterday, The Violet Hour, The Music Man, The Iceman Cometh, Arcadia, Philadelphia, Here I Come, The Speed of Darkness, Breaking the Code, and Brighton Beach Memoirs. In 2018, he won an Obie for Edward Albee's At Home at the Zoo, Home Life and the Zoo Story. He recently played the ill-fated Reverend Matthew Forte on The Gilded Age and was Dr. James Wilson for all 176 episodes of House. His many roles on film include In the Gloaming, The Age of Innocence, Much Ado About Nothing, and Dead Poets Society. Well, I'm very excited to talk to you because I know that your involvement in Into the Woods was really at the earliest stages, of which there is the least information available anywhere. People's memories are so hazy.
It's also at the earliest part of me as well.
So you were in high school, I think, at the time. Is that right?
What year would that have been? Was it 85? I don't remember.
Maybe. So I know that you, I believe by a lot of sources that you were in a workshop at mm-hmm. Playwrights Horizons right. in June of 86.
Okay, 86. So I was 15. Yes, I was still in high school. I dropped out at 16. So I was in high school. I must have just done this play with Cynthia Nixon at the Perry Street Theater called Sally's Gone, She Left Her Name. It was my very first play in New York. I had understudied a play at the Public Theater before that, but I was definitely a kid actor. There were more successful ones certainly around. And I don't recall how I got involved or even how this audition came my way.
Had you done Brighton Beach Memoirs before this?
Oh, God, no. I did that in 86, the summer of 86.
So right after. Well, the other question is that there was a reading, just like a one-day table read, I believe in like November of 85. Danielle Ferlin thinks you were there with her, but nobody remembers anything about this reading. Does that ring a bell to you? No music.
No. I'd remember that. Danielle Ferlin's crazy. But I'm glad she thinks of me even when I wasn't there. No, I didn't join until the Playwrights Workshop.
Okay. And so what do you remember? Did you audition for that?
I did. I recall going in. I don't know why for the life of me I did not have a song prepared. I wasn't a singer. I didn't consider myself a singer. Maybe James knew me from this play that I had done at Circle Rep. I'd done that, or I don't know. I had done a few plays by then, but not many, maybe two. I don't quite know how. I mean, it's, you know, when you're 16 and 15 and 14 in New York, it's I always tell young actors, aside from work as much as you can, my advice is always start as early as you can, because by the time everyone flooded New York from Carnegie Mellon and all the other colleges, I'd been working for 8 years.
Wow.
So, and also, you know, when you audition for a TV commercial or a movie and you need a 12-year-old, the room is filled. But if you're doing a play at the Perry Street Theater, who the hell wants to do that? Certainly, what parent wants their kid to do that in the middle of school? So, you know, always, for those kinds of things, there were always two or three or four people auditioning. And maybe it's different now, but...
Were your parents very generous about, like, driving you in and out of... Because you lived in New Jersey, I think.
I did. No, they never drove me in. I took a bus from... I lived in Ridgewood, New Jersey, where I still live. There's a bus that goes up Route 17, goes to the Port Authority. It's about a half hour. So that was my life. I was on that bus for, I don't know, from... 2 years, 14, maybe two and a half. I moved into New York before I turned 17 illegally. I had a cousin sign a lease for me. But two and a half years, I took the bus back and forth. And when at the very beginning, ushers would meet me, like when I worked at the Public Theater, an usher would meet me at Port Authority and bring me down to Astor Place.
Yeah, because Port Authority in 1985, I mean, that was the ultimate Port Authority.
It was the way it was almost Midnight Cowboy time.
Wow.
I don't know what they were thinking. I would certainly be very uncomfortable with my daughters doing it, but I don't know. It was a different time.
Yeah. But,
so by the time James and Stephen were workshopping or starting this workshop, I guess I must have been somewhat known to them, maybe by Daniel Swee or some other casting director, but I don't recall if the audition was flooded or if there were many kids there.
Known to you? I mean, were you like a musical theater nerd at all?
Are you kidding me? After I saw Sunday in the Park, I couldn't stand up after the first act.
Wow.
I think I saw it four times.
Wow.
Sunday was my baptism. I didn't know their earlier work either. James as a playwright or Stephen as everything he was, but I was not an actor's actor. It's a long story, but I didn't really start acting. I started in a very small company in New Jersey, which was a theater camp, but I wasn't a member. My mother painted signs for them, and they used our local high school theater, and I would help her in the basement paint the signs, the sandwich board signs that they put out in front. And they would throw me on stage whenever they needed a kid, because the camp was for 16 to 22 year olds. And they did 10 shows, typical kind of summer stock, but a camp. So they would throw me on stage, and because I was the only kid around. And I started doing, so it wasn't, by the time I hit New York, it was quite by happenstance. I was excited to figure this place, this world out, but I was in no way a theater nerd. I didn't know much about Stephen Sondheim or James Lapine at that point.
And so you didn't have a song to audition with?
No, which is very strange. I don't know why I didn't. I must have known what I was there for. And I don't know why my agent, I had a very small agent, but still. So I don't know. Maybe they told me not to. That wouldn't surprise me. That sounds like something James might do. And also, you know, keep in mind, no songs had been written. So they didn't know what kind of voice they would need.
Did they have you sing like Happy Birthday or something?
Exactly. That is actually what you must have talked to other actors as well. Yeah, I sang Happy Birthday. And they said, thank you very much. And I left. And then I was somehow cast.
So what do you remember about that process? I think like you got music as it went on, if I'm correct.
Yes, it was a play. There were, I'm still pretty much a novice when it comes to musical theater, even after 40 years, but maybe this is how it always is, but I've never been in a musical from its inception, except this one time. It was a play with blocks of dialogue that were clearly meant going to be songs. You know, Cinderella would have a long speech about how confused she is and why she's at the palace and why she can't leave and, you know, all those things. So But Steve had not, I don't believe he'd written a note yet. I heard the very first, I only remember this because Howard McGillan, who played one of the princes.
Yeah.
I only remember this because I was a kid, but he turned to Mary Darcy, who played Cinderella, and said, I'll never forget hearing that. And I remember that image. I remember him saying that to her. And it was because Steve came in. I may get this wrong. God knows I could. For in my memory, the very first musical note that was played at that workshop was Steve came in and said, oh, I thought of something for Howard and Mary. Or maybe it was Patrick. Patrick Quinn played the other one.
Mm.
It was, I never thought I'd wed a prince. I never thought I'd ever find you. And that was it. And it was beautiful. And Howard, or I think it was Howard, turned to Mary and said, I'll never forget hearing that.
Wow.
I remember that. James may disagree. I don't, but that was the first musical moment I remember. But yeah, it was a play. And I think that might have even been the first day or the second day. I don't think it was that long a rehearsal process. We went on. It was, you must know the cast. I remember Ray Gill played the
Baker.
I remember Betty Buckley played the witch. Barbara Brynn, of course, played mom, as she always does. Mary Darcy, I don't remember who Rapunzel was. Rapunzel was, I don't think Rapunzel even spoke in the play version. Maybe she did. I don't recall a Rapunzel. But, and of course, Daniel.
Danielle. Yes. And the stepsisters were Nancy Opel and Janice Schneider.
Yes, I remember them.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite a cast, boy, for a reading, I have to say.
Totally. Bob Gunton was the narrator.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And let's see. John Carpenter was the mysterious man.
Oh, what a...
Well, and Joanna Gleason was the baker's wife.
Of course. Yes.
But so,
go ahead. She and Barbara were the only two that I think stayed with it all the way through.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, James talked about how much he loved Ray Gill. And Ira Weitzman said there was like an elaborate ruse when they couldn't cast Ray in San Diego, that they had to sort of trick James into falling in love with Chip as the baker because he was such a different type from Ray. And I know Ray went on to later do the national tour as the baker. I'm curious what you remember. What was it that made Ray? So other people have also said just how wonderful Ray was.
Ray was, I love Chip Zine and I loved him in it. Ray, as a kid, keep in mind, this is a 15-year-old's perspective over a lot of foggy years. But what I remember most was he was extremely simple and quite befuddled in a way that Chip can be befuddled too, but he never seemed quite that befuddled because he's just too smart. He seems like a smart cookie on stage, no matter what his dilemma is. Ray really seemed like a guy hit by a truck. You know, he really did seem like a baker. I don't quite buy Chip Zine as a baker. I thought he was great in the show, but I know what James meant.
Yeah.
He was a baker.
Yeah.
And Joanna, and I think that made her journey a little more, I don't know, different, because she went from being, she became a very, very interesting woman by the end of that play and didn't really start as one. Mm. And I think Ray became a very different man, not in the same way. Joanna's, you know, the baker's wife grew in a way that was astounding in that play. And the baker got brave and learned some tricks of, you know, protect people and what life is about, but he remained sort of the same soul. I think Joanna's the real, or I always say Joanna because that's, to me, that's the who she is. That journey from that woman is in that play is, I mean, the witch is great, Jack is great, you know, Red Riding, it's great, but Baker's wife is, there's no other part like it in that play, whether James meant to do that or not. He's, or Stephen, I don't know.
That's interesting that was so clear even in that early incarnation.
It's possible. I'm overlaying it with years of thinking, but I do remember that about Ray, that he reminds me when I did Long Day's Journey Into Night with Brian Dennehy and Vanessa Redgrave. I remember I thought about him a little because Brian, I loved Brian's James Tyrone and I loved Vanessa's Mary, but James, Brian really broke my heart because he really did seem like a very simple guy. And I always see James Lapine as a very, James Tyrone as a very complicated guy. And I sort of enjoyed Brian's take on it, that he just wanted, you know, this crazy woman to just calm down, you know, life's, why is it so hard? It's not so hard. You just trim the hedges and BS the neighbors and, you know, wear an ascot. And I sort of felt that way about Ray. He was a baker. Like people are mailmen. And Joanna was a mystery. And I think Chip is always a mystery. So in the final production, they were both a mystery, which works too.
Yeah. And what about Betty Buckley? I mean, I've always been so intrigued by what she must have been like as the witch and, you know, one of the great, I imagine a great performance that people never got to see. What was it like to watch her do that?
She was frightening. She was very different. She's a very different animal than Bernadette. I don't know either of them very well, but or really at all. But she was. I don't know. You know, James is a pretty salty guy, and he's. You know, he's been described as. You know, he's not the warmest, cuddliest guy on earth. I adore him, and I. Admire him immensely, and I would work for him anywhere, doing anything. I think he's a true theatrical, unique character in my world, in my career, and I feel honored to have crossed paths with him. And I've always thought his pull on Stephen was from Sunday through Passion was had a darkness to it that was very good for Stephen. From my limited knowledge, that's my opinion. And I think the witch was one of those characters. She, you know, all when you think about it, the laughs, the levity of that character, I think all come from Steve. You know, the rutabagas and things. Obviously, James might slap me silly and tell me I'm wrong, but I imagine James wrote that as a pretty dark journey. And there is no sugarcoating in that role. I mean, that's her role in the play, is to say, you know, for F's sake, death, people die, people are killed, people betray, all the things that the baker's father tries to, you know, let him know and teach him how to live with, move on from. The witch is in spades in that role, in that play.
Yeah.
When I saw it finally, it surprised me how she seemed more just kind of another character. And when we did it, she was a bit of a black hole in the scene. Of it all, a magnetic force of dark, not evil, as she says, or who says witches can be right, giants can be good?
She does, yeah.
You know, she's not evil, but not good either. Certainly not nice, but
yeah,
herself and the truth, I guess. So she seemed to be a dark, powerful center of the play that dissipated a bit as the production aged and went into versions, it seems. But yeah, I remember her being quite scary, very unlike anyone else in the play. You know, like every time she'd leave, it was like, oh, thank God, we can get back to the play.
Yeah.
You know, that mad woman's gone. Like, remember the mad woman in Sweeney, you know, that kind of.
Wow.
really unnerving, like, oh Christ, when, let's get back to the play now that she's gone. You know, she would kind of stop the world when she came on.
And fascinating.
I didn't feel that with Bernadette. Not that there's anything wrong with what Bernadette did, or anything less than stupendous and beautiful as she always is, but very different.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
What about her material? I mean, I know that the Witch's big sort of truth-telling song, Last Midnight, was added late in Broadway previews. Her big ballad, Children Will Listen, was added late in Broadway previews.
Yeah.
I believe the beautiful ballad that she sings to Rapunzel, Stay With Me, was not added until after they got back from San Diego. So did she only have the rap, or were there other witch songs in that workshop?
I mean, as I said, she didn't have anything when we started.
Yeah.
We just, so, you know, it was just Betty Buckley tearing us all a new one, you know,
just monologues.
Yeah. Like, and scenes, you know, like, you know, the Rutabaga scene was a scene. There was it was just her nailing Ray to the wall.
Wow.
You know, the witch had never come in that house before. I mean, it was terrifying. The witch is here. There was nothing. I mean, you know, of course it's a little campy, and it's always, that's James's take on it. And it's always rompy.
Yeah.
But at the time, you know, Betty Buckley will not take to being in a romp. She won't stand for it. So she didn't, she said, you can do what you want. I'm not going to be in a romp. I'm going to scare the shit out of this guy. And I don't recall how much music was written for Betty, and it wouldn't surprise me if none had been by the time we were done our.
Yeah.
But maybe the rap that was written, I don't know. But it makes sense to me that that character would be a ninth inning problem.
Yeah.
For both Steve and James to figure out just exactly what she is in that play. As I've said, I thought about it. I've thought about it so many times. So I'm sure by the time San Diego was done, there was a question as to what she was in that play.
Yeah.
And how she, because it was very rompy and very campy and very funny. But she sort of can't be, you know? And she, I think she, her presence makes things like No More work and not clash with the silliness that James and Stephen have given us. To find a song where you're weeping.
Yeah.
I think The Witch has a lot to do with that, but so I don't know. I don't know. James would know. I don't know if any music had been written for her by the time we were done. I only did that one workshop, and I didn't do San Diego because James, I don't remember if he admits this or not, but I called him. I had an offer to do a teen movie called My Best Friend is a Vampire. And it was the time when everyone was making those dumb movies.
Yeah.
Patrick, you know, what's his name? Casey Shamashko. And there were all these guys making everyone wanted to make it, you know, teen movies were it. Bad teen movies. This was even pre-John Hughes, really.
Yeah.
And I was offered the lead in this movie. I have no idea why. And maybe, I think someone had seen Brighton Beach, but I called James, and it conflicted with San Diego, and I was going to say no. And James said, Bobby, I think you should do the movie. And I said, oh, why? And he said, I don't remember. I mean, I've worked with him so many times since then, but I don't remember if I've ever brought this up, but he said, Bobby, and I mean this in the nicest way, your future is not in the musical theater.
Wow. Wow.
And he was right.
Yeah.
I'm not a singer. I can sing. I can do Harold Hill, you know, but I'm not. And I think that was very, I was a kid, you know, he talks exactly the same way to kids as he does to adults. It's, you know, I noticed that with the little girl in Sunday when we did the revival.
Yeah.
What was her name? She's going to kill me. The little girl who played the little girl, you know, James, her notes sounded very much like the notes he gave Jake. Mm. You know, he's just, his filter fell out of his head at some point. I don't know where it went, but I love watching him in action.
Were you as a kid able to take that in stride, or was that a learning curve for you to take notes like that?
Well, I didn't. You mean that curveball of don't come with us, your future?
Maybe that, or even just in the process.
Oh, I don't remember any notes in the process.
No,
I think he was so busy just writing, and he wasn't too concerned about the actors. I think he was just. His work was to go home and write. He just listened. Right. Howie was sort of not that important at that point.
Interesting. About the things that were you able to see in that process what in his eyes or in his and Sondheim's eyes were the sort of problem spots or the holes that they seemed to be focused on working on?
No, I was way under that radar. I really was. I'm not even sure, Joanna would have known that, but she probably would. She seems to know everything, but I was a kid. Danielle and I were kids. I mean, I don't recall that. I mean, in hindsight, it's fun to, as we just sort of tripped through the whole witch dilemma. Like I'd never really thought about the problem as everyone's combed through the problems of Merrily so many times.
Yeah. Right.
So I don't know what there must have been many, because that musical is just a huge mess. My God. Way more than Sunday, or even Passion in a way. It's a real puzzle, and there's a lot to figure out, and it's unique. The whole style of it is unique. And I'm sure there were, it's a directorial dream or nightmare, I guess, depending on.
Yeah. So he told you to take the movie, so you did. Was it an obvious thing in your mind that this was, after San Diego, going to go to Broadway? Or did you think, you know, what was your expectation coming out of it?
My head wasn't in that place yet as an actor. I did a workshop of Flying Over Sunset, James's last show.
Yeah.
And David Turner and some other people, friends of mine, were in it. And, oh boy, we talked about that for, you know, there were texts and emails galore for days and days and days after that workshop. And we probably thought about it more than James did. So, you know, and then of course we didn't get called back. So, you know, but I wasn't in that zone yet. I don't even remember tracking what happened in San Diego, and also I didn't know. And, you know, now when a play is cast and it's being done somewhere, I know, always know at least seven people in it. I didn't know anybody. So,
sure.
You know, when it left, it left. I didn't, you know, James wasn't conferring with me. So I didn't really track it, but it was, you know, so I don't recall what I was thinking between saying yes to a movie and Into the Woods opening on Broadway. I don't really, it wasn't a part of my life really.
But you saw it on Broadway.
I did. Yes. I saw it very early on. I don't think it was a preview, although it might've been. I went with, I think it was John Rogan, this old English friend of mine, but no, I didn't. But I didn't go back, you know, I didn't want to see all I knew. The only people I knew were Danielle and Danielle tracked all the way as well. Danielle, yeah. Joanne, and Barbara.
And Joy Franz.
Oh, yes. How funny, of course. So, you know, we weren't pals. I don't think I've ever seen Danielle. I've hardly seen her since then, but so I didn't go back or anything, but I did see it. And I loved it. I do think it's a mess in the best way. I think it's extremely sloppy in the way that like Robert Altman's films are. I think it's in a very good way. It's just very, you know, because those fairy tales are so neat and tidy, and yet under the surface, they're so bloody and complicated. So I think James chose a great basket to put it in. It's just this, you don't quite know where you are or what they want from you, these people who've staged this. At least that's how I felt. I didn't know what it was. Is this like a farce, or is this a serious play, or is it a horror or play? I think James was very smart in that, because what can it be? It's just got to be a little of everything. It's always been a very unique musical. I'm sure everyone else who loves it would agree. But I loved seeing, when I saw it, I did love it. And I was a huge, Bernadette Peters, I still can't say her name without stuttering. So
yeah,
I would have seen her in anything.
That's so interesting, the Robert Altman comparison. You know, I think you've just actually reconciled for me this thing about Into the Woods that is like, some of the younger generations kind of just take it as it's their Sondheim entry point, and they consider it, you know, the greatest, and, you know, it's accessible to children on a different level, and it's done in high schools. And so people just also have familiarity bias, I think, for it. And then, you know, people are surprised who weren't around then to read the Frank Rich review from the time, which was quite negative, for a mixed review. And, but this lens to look at it as like a mess in the best way, like a Robert Altman film, and just all these sort of different things in the salad of it mixed together, that's so interesting and so different from other Sondheim musicals that, you know, have such precision and calibration and, you know, stylistic integrity. Have you felt that different? I assume you've seen other productions. I know you've seen the film. Were there other approaches to the material over the years that seemed to deal with that facet of it better or worse in any way?
The facet of how to tell the story, or the facet of how do you mean?
Well, sort of how to tell it, and how to sort of choose one of those lanes to be on so the audience knows what it is.
I asked you to qualify or quantify, explaining your question a bit more, only to tell you actually that I've never seen another production. I've seen a school production of it once that I really enjoyed. Are there many? I guess there was that one that Tim Sheeter brought over from London in the park.
Yeah.
I actually auditioned for that by mail. I went on tape and sent him a tape. But I did not get it. But and I know that was unique.
Yeah.
And some didn't like it, and some did. There haven't been that many.
Well, there were also two Broadway revivals, one directed by Lapine 20 years ago, and one just came from City Center recently. And then there was an off-Broadway production by the Fiasco Theater Company, where all the sets and props are found, and costumes are found objects, and it's a small cast, double cast, and surprising, you know, it was like a very sort of strings attached kind of let's put on a show, maybe like the Fantastics or something. It was a really cool, different take. That had a long run, I think, and toured. So it seems like it's been around a lot.
Well, great. Well, that shows you how little I'm. All I do is drive my girls to, you know, gymnastics and make breakfast at the moment. I don't know. And I never saw that. I've never been a huge theater goer in my younger years. But and I didn't actually see the film. I'm ashamed to say after throwing out my tomato at it for not including No More. But no, I didn't actually see it. But no, I just know what I saw that day on Broadway and what happened at Playwrights.
Yeah. Well, the playwrights is really the inception. Did you get? I know there was an earlier version of Giants in the Sky that was a little more powdery that they had in San Diego. Is that? Did you have that eventually in that workshop?
Yep, my friend John Sherman, Jonathan Mark Sherman, who's a playwright and a friend to everyone apparently in New York City, says the only thing I can say that makes him jealous is when the day Stephen walked in and pointed to me and said, "This one's for Bobby." And then he sat down and went flap, 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 and unflapped this, you know, 37 page tome. So yes, it was an endless patter, beautiful, nutty thing. I know Giants of the Sky fairly well in my head now, so and I wish I could tell you the difference. I did indeed have that day when I didn't have anything. I had the Milky White stuff,
Goodbye Old Pal.
Yeah, Goodbye Old Pal. That was all I had for a long time. And then Steve came in and said, "Oh, this is for Bobby," and played that. So, and we had, our scripts were enormous, and we had these binders, and we actually had to, you know, not blocking, but a little bit of movement and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was hard because we had these enormous binders, and that song, oh my God. I was very nervous about it. I was very nervous about dropping the binder in the middle of it. Lots of things.
Do you remember anything about Sondheim singing the songs for you?
Yes, I do remember him doing that. I mean, I certainly remember those two little lines from Cinderella and her Prince song.
Happy.
He did always do that. He would always come in and whatever it was, he would play it for you.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, looking back on now, at the time, I just thought, oh, I guess this is the way theater works. You know, I thought I'd be doing shows with Stephen Sondheim the rest of my life. It was pretty special. I don't think I, as Thornton Wilder will attest to, I don't think I was in any way remotely realizing my own existence as I was in it.
Well, you did do Sunday in the Park with George years later, a rare musical in your career, but not the only one. You also were in The Music Man, and I think you did Camelot at Westport.
Yes, I did. That's great. Thank you for knowing that.
You mentioned Workshop of Flying Over Sunset. Are there any other musical theater or specifically Sondheim almost rans or things we might not know about?
No, not for me. I mean, James called me about Sunset. I think he was sort of just trying the role out on a bunch of people. I think Kevin Kline did it after me. And then he called me about Sunday, and I thought, oh, you know, I mean, Sunday was probably the most important musical of my youth.
Wow.
I wrote in my bio for it, we can only have so many words. I don't know why, but so I didn't list any credits. I can't remember exactly what I wrote, but I basically just said that when I saw the original version of this, I went directly to Colony Records and bought the cassette and proceeded to literally wear it out in my Walkman. I only wish that you could do that tonight and also that you would, because Colony's long gone. But
yeah.
That was all I wrote because that's what I remember. It affected me deeply. So when James called me about it, I didn't even hesitate, but a part of me did think, oh, you know, Jules, of all people, the one guy who doesn't think George is a good artist. Like, what a fun part to play. Oh, this painting is ridiculous. You know, and I tried so hard to, you know, to play different colors, and James just, you know, every time would say no, and Sarna was the director, but
yeah,
James would occasionally come in and Sarna, you know, help us out, but no, he did not. He doesn't want many multicolors. The soft underbelly side, unexplored side of Jules, you know. But it was very, it was great fun to do it. And great fun to live in it and hear the music and the orchestra. And I thought Annalie and Jake were wonderful. But
yes. Well, so are you. You did justice to the sophistication and authority of Charles Kimbrough. So I'm glad you took on the unlikable bad guy for the team.
I praise. Thank you.
Well, thank you for this. It's so great. This really was history, that workshop. And so, you know, to have your reminiscences about it is really a great piece of the puzzle.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad. Sorry it took me so long to get back to you about it. I'm notoriously bad at this kind of stuff, but getting back to you. But it's lovely to talk about it. It was great to be here with you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day. I look forward to seeing you, and not on season 3 of The Gilded Age, sadly, but on many things and in many things.
You too, Ben. Well, you as well. Keep on, you know, working ahead.
Thank you for listening to Giants in the Sky, how Sondheim and Lapine went into the woods on the Broadway Podcast Network. Look out for episode 53 with Marianne Kane, stage manager on Broadway.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.